and thought that some defect in my own vision was multiplying Ita's eyes. At last I pulled away from Roach and vomited great quantities of black water. After that I was better. I could sit up and breathe again in a crippled way, and though I had no strength and my hands shook, I could move my arms. The eyes around me belonged to real people, the denizens of the Riverside tenements. A woman brought a bowl of some hot drink. I could not be sure if it was soup or tea, only that it was scalding and somewhat salty and smelled of smoke. I pretended to drink it, and afterward found that I had slight burns on my lips and tongue.
"Were you trying to do that?" Trot asked. "How did you come up?"
I shook my head.
Someone in the crowd said, "He shot right out of the water."
Roach helped me steady my hand.
"We thought you'd come up somewhere else, that you were playing a joke on us."
I said, "I saw Malrubius." An old man, a boatman from his tar-stained clothes, took Roach by the shoulder.
"Who's that?"
"Used to be master of apprentices. He's dead."
"Not a woman?"
The old man was holding Roach, but looking at me. "No, no," Roach told him. "There are no women in our guild." Despite the hot drink and the warmth of the day, I was cold. One of the youths we sometimes fought brought a dusty blanket, and I wrapped myself in it. But it was so long before I was strong enough to walk again that by the time we reached the gate of the necropolis, the statue of Night atop the Khan on the opposite bank was a minute scratch of black against the sun's field of flame, and the gate itself stood closed and locked. Chapter 3 The Autarch's Face. It was mid-morning of the next day before I thought to look at the coin Vodalus had given me. After serving the journeymen in the refectory, we had breakfasted as usual, met Master Palamon in our classroom, and after a brief preparatory lecture followed him to the lower levels to view the work of the preceding night. But perhaps before I write further, I should explain something more of the nature of our Matchin Tower. It is situated toward the back of the citadel, upon the western side. At ground level are the studies of our masters, where consultations with the officers of justice and the heads of other guilds are conducted. Our common room is above them, with its back to the kitchen. Above that is the refectory, which serves us as an assembly hall as well as an eating place. Above it are the private cabins of the masters, in better days much more numerous. Above these are the journeymen's cabins, and above them the apprentices' dormitory and classroom, and a series of attics and abandoned cubicles. Near the very top is the gun room, whose remaining pieces we of the guild are charged with serving should the citadel suffer attack. The real work of our guild is carried out below all this. Just underground lies the examination room. Beneath it, and thus outside the tower proper, for the examination room was the propulsion chamber of the original structure, stretches the labyrinth of the oubliette. There are three usable levels, reached by a central stairwell. The cells are plain, dry, and clean, equipped with a small table, a chair, and a narrow bed fixed in the center of the floor. The lights of the oubliette are of that ancient kind that is said to burn forever, though some have now gone out. In the gloom of those corridors, my feelings that morning were not gloomy, but joyous. Here I would labor when I became a journeyman. Here I would practice the ancient art and raise myself to the rank of master. Here I would lay the foundation for the restoration of our guild to its former glory. The very air of the place seemed to wrap me like a blanket that had been warmed before some clean-scented fire. We halted before the door of a cell, and the journeyman on duty rattled his key in the lock. Inside, the client lifted her head, opening dark eyes very wide. Master Palamon wore the sable-trimmed cloak and velvet mask of his rank. I suppose that these, or the protruding optical device that permitted him to see, must have frightened her. She did not speak, and of course none of us spoke to her. "Here," Master Palamon began in his driest tone, "we have something outside the routine of judicial punishment and well illustrative of modern technique. The client was put to the question last night. Perhaps some of you heard her. 20 minims of tincture were given before the excruciation and 10 after. The dose was only partially effective in preventing shock and loss of consciousness, so the proceedings were terminated after flaying the right leg, as you will see." He gestured to Drott, who began unwrapping the bandages.
"Half boot?" Roach asked.
"No, full boot. She has been a maidservant, and Master Gerlow says he has found them strong-skinned. In this instance, he was proved correct. A simple circular incision was made below the knee, and its edge taken with 8 clamps. Careful work by Master Gerlows, Odo, Menace, and Igel permitted the removal of everything between the knee and the toes without further help from the knife.
We gathered around Drott, the younger boys pushing in as they pretended they knew the points to look for. The arteries and major veins were all intact, but there was a slow, generalized welling of blood. I helped Drott apply fresh dressings. Just as we were about to leave, the woman said,
I don't know. Only, oh, can't you believe I wouldn't tell you if I did? She's gone with Vodalus of the Wood. I don't know where.
Outside, feigning ignorance, I asked Master Palamon who Vodalus of the Wood was.
How often have I explained that nothing said by a client under questioning is heard by you?
Many times, Master.
But to no effect. Soon it will be masking day, and Drott and Roach will be journeymen, and you, captain of apprentices. Is this the example you'll set the boys?
No, Master. Behind the old man's back, Drott gave me a look that meant he knew much about Vodalus and would tell me at a convenient time.
Once the journeymen of our guild were deafened, would you have those days again? Take your hands from your pockets when I speak to you, Severian.
I had put them there because I knew it would distract his anger. But as I drew them out, I realized I had been fumbling the coin Vodalus had given me the night before. In the remembered terror of the fight, I had forgotten it. Now I was in agony to look at it, and could not, with Master Palamon's bright lens fixed on me.
When a client speaks, Severian, you hear nothing. Nothing whatsoever. Think of mice, whose squeaking conveys no meaning to men.
I squinted to indicate that I was thinking of mice.
All the long, weary way up the stair to our classroom, I ached to look at the thin disc of metal I clutched, but I knew that if I were to do so, the boy behind me, as it happened, one of the younger apprentices, Eusebius, would see it.
In the classroom where Master Palamon droned over a 10-day corpse, the coin was like a coal of fire, and I dared not look. It was afternoon before I found privacy, hiding myself in the ruins of the curtain wall among the shining mosses, then hesitating with my fist poised in a ray of sun because I was afraid that when I saw it at last, the disappointment would be more than I could bear. Not because I cared for its value. Though I was already a man, I had had so little money that any coin would have seemed a fortune to me. Rather, it was that the coin, so mysterious now but not likely to remain so, was my only link with the night before, my only connection with Vodalus and the beautiful hooded woman and the heavy man who had struck at me with a shovel, my only booty from the fight of the opened grave. My life in the guild was the only life I had known, and it seemed as drab as my ragged shirt in comparison with the flash of the exultant's sword blade and the sound of the shot echoing among the stones. All that might be gone when I opened my hand. In the end, I looked, having drained the dregs of pleasant dread. The coin was a gold chrysos, and I closed my hand once more, fearing that I had only mistaken a brass oracoch, and waited until I found my courage again. It was the first time I had ever touched a piece of gold. Oracochs I had seen in some plenty, and I had even possessed a few of my own. Silver asimi I had glimpsed once or twice. But chrysos I knew only in the same dim way I knew of the existence of a world outside our city of Nessus, and of continents other than our own to the north and east and west. This one bore what I at first thought was a woman's face, a woman crowned, neither young nor old, but silent and perfect in the citrine metal. At last I turned my treasure over, and then indeed I caught my breath. Stamped on the reverse was just such a flying ship as I had seen in the arms above the door of my secret mausoleum. It seemed beyond explanation, so much so that at the time I did not even trouble to speculate about it, so sure was I that any speculation would be fruitless. Instead, I thrust the coin back into my pocket and went in a species of trance to rejoin my fellow apprentices. To carry the coin about with me was out of the question. As soon as there was an opportunity to do so, I slipped into the necropolis alone and sought out my mausoleum. The weather had turned that day. I pushed through drenching shrubbery and trudged over long, aged grass that had begun to flatten itself for winter. When I reached my retreat, it was no longer the cool, inviting cave of summer, but an icy trap where I sensed the nearness of enemies too vague for names, opponents of Vodalus who surely knew by now that I was his sworn supporter. As soon as I entered, they would rush forward to swing the black door shut on newly oiled hinges. I knew that it was nonsense, of course, yet I also knew there was truth in it, that it was a proximity in time, I felt. In a few months or a few years, I might reach the point at which those enemies waited for me. When I had swung the axe I had chosen to fight, a thing a torturer does not normally do.
There was a loose stone in the floor, almost at the foot of my funeral bronze. I pried it up and put the chrysos under it, then muttered an incantation I had learned years before from Roach, a few lines of verse that would hold hidden objects safe. Where I put you, there you lie. Never let a stranger spy, like glass grow to any eye not of me. Here be safe, never leave it. Should a hand come, deceive it. Let strange eyes not believe it till I see. For the charm to be really effective, one had to walk around the spot at midnight carrying a corpse candle, but I found myself laughing at the thought, which suggested Drott's mummery about simples drawn at midnight from graves, and decided to rely on the verse alone, though I was somewhat astonished to discover that I was now old enough not to be ashamed of it. Days passed, and memory of my visit to the mausoleum remained vivid enough to dissuade me from making another to verify that my treasure was safe, though at times I longed to do so. Then came the first snow, turning the ruins of the curtain wall into an almost impassably slippery barrier, and the familiar necropolis into a strange wilderness of deceptive hummocks in which monuments were suddenly too large under their coats of new snow, and the trees and bushes crushed to half size by theirs. It is the nature of apprenticeship in our guild that, though easy at first, its burdens grow greater and greater as one comes to manhood. The smallest boys do no work at all. At the age of 6, when work begins, it is at first no more than running up and down the stairs of the Matichin Tower with messages, and the little apprentice, proud of being entrusted with them, hardly feels the labor. As time progresses, however, his work becomes more and more onerous. His duties take him to other parts of the citadel, to the soldiers in the barbican, where he learns that the military apprentices have drums and trumpets and opoclides and boots and sometimes gilded cuirasses, to the bear tower, where he sees boys no older than himself learning to handle wonderful fighting animals of all kinds, mastiffs with heads as large as a lion's, diatrimi, taller than a man, with beaks sheathed in steel, and to 100 other such places where he discovers for the first time that his guild is hated and despised even by those, indeed most of all by those, who make use of its services. Soon there is scrubbing and kitchen work. Brother Cook performs such cooking as might be interesting or pleasurable, and the apprentice is left to pare vegetables, serve the journeyman, and carry an endless succession of stacks of trays down the stairs to the oubliette. I did not know it at the time, but soon this apprentice life of mine, which had been growing harder for as long as I could remember, would reverse its course and become less drudging and more pleasant. In the year before he used to become a journeyman, a senior apprentice does little but supervise the work of his juniors. His food and even his dress improve. The younger journeymen begin to treat him almost as an equal, and he has, above all, the elevating burden of responsibility and the pleasure of issuing and enforcing orders. When his elevation comes, he is an adult. He does no work but that for which he has been trained, and he is free to leave the citadel when his duties are over, for which recreation he is supplied with liberal funds. Should he eventually rise to mastership, an honor that requires the affirmative votes of all the living masters, he will be able to pick and choose such assignments as may interest or amuse him and direct the affairs of the guild itself. But you must understand that in the year I have been writing of, the year in which I saved the life of Vodalus, I was unconscious of all that. Winter, I was told, had ended the campaigning season in the north and thus brought the autarch and his chief officers and advisers back to the seats of justice. And so, as Roach explained, we have all these new clients and more to come, dozens, maybe hundreds. We might have to reopen the fourth level. He waved a freckled hand to show that he at least was ready to do whatever might be necessary. Is he here? I asked. The autarch? Here in the citadel? In the great keep? Of course not. If he ever came, you'd know it, wouldn't you? There'd be parades and inspections and all kinds of goings on. There's a suite for him there, but the door hasn't been opened in 100 years. He'll be in the hidden palace, the house absolute, north of the city someplace. Don't you know where? Roach grew defensive. You can't say where it is, because there's nothing there except the House Absolute itself. It's where it is, to the north, on the other bank.
Beyond the wall?
He smiled on my ignorance. Far past it. Weeks if you walked. Naturally, the autarch could get here by flyer in an instant if he wanted to. The flag tower, that's where the flyer would land.
But our new clients did not come in flyers. The less important arrived in coffles of 10 to 20 men and women, chained one behind the other by the neck. They were guarded by demarchi, hard-bitten troopers in armor that looked as if it had been made for use and used. Each client carried a copper cylinder supposedly containing his or her papers and thus his or her fate.
All of them had broken the seals and read those papers, of course, and some had destroyed them or exchanged them for another's. Those who arrived without papers would be held until some further word concerning their disposition was received, probably for the remainder of their lives. Those who had exchanged papers with someone else had exchanged fates. They would be held or released, tortured or executed, in another's stead. The more important arrived in armored carriages. The steel sides and barred windows of these vehicles were not intended to prevent escape so much as to thwart rescue, and no sooner had the first of them thundered around the east side of the Witch's Tower and entered the old yard than the whole guild was filled with rumors of daring raids contemplated or attempted by Vodalus. For all my fellow apprentices and most of the journeymen believed that many of these clients were his henchmen, confederates, and allies. I would not have released them for that reason. It would have brought disgrace on the guild, which for all my attachment to him and his movement I was unready to do, and would have been impossible anyway. But I hoped to provide those I considered my comrades-in-arms with such small comforts as lay within my power, extra food stolen from the trays of less deserving clients, and occasionally a bit of meat smuggled from the kitchen. One blustering day I was given the opportunity to learn who they were. I was scrubbing the floor in Master Gerlow's study when he was called away on some errand, leaving his table stacked with newly arrived dossiers. I hurried over as soon as the door had clanged behind him, and was able to skim most of them before I heard his heavy tread on the stair again. Not one of the prisoners whose papers I had read had been an adherent of Vodalus. There were merchants who had tried to make rich profits on supplies needed by the army, camp followers who had spied for the Asians, and a sprinkling of sordid civil criminals. Nothing else. When I carried my bucket out to empty in the stone sink in the old yard, I saw one of the armored carriages halted there with its long maned team steaming and stamping, and the guards in their fur-trimmed helmets sheepishly accepting our smoking goblets of mulled wine. I caught the name Vodalus in the air, but at that moment it seemed I was the only one who heard it, and suddenly I felt Vodalus had been only an eidolon created by my imagination from the fog, and only the man I had slain with his own axe real. The dossiers I had fumbled through a moment before seemed blown like leaves against my face. It was in this instant of confusion that I realized for the first time that